Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Mormonism Live. This is Radio Free Mormon. How are you, Mr. Rio?
I am great, RFM. I have to chuckle every time because every time I got to look to my left where you are definitely not.
Yes.
And then it shows up on the screen as if I'm looking towards you. So
I'm getting better at that.
Yeah.
We have to do everything the opposite here just because of the way it shows up on the screen. But I'm glad that everybody is here who is here tonight because we've got a great show this evening. This is Mormonism Live number 173, episode 173. Today's date is March 27th, 2024. Mr. Real, do you have any announcements to make before we begin tonight's show?
No, I think you had mentioned doing this in your show that you released, that you're actually going to release tomorrow night, but that you played a little video that I put together to ask for donations. And somewhere in the middle of this show tonight, if you don't mind, I'll interrupt us and play that. But otherwise, life is good, and I hope everybody's doing well, and I'm really excited. You've got a great guest and a great show for tonight.
Thank you very much. The title of tonight's show, if I haven't said it already, is LDS Church Financial Apologetics. And what the show is about is, you may remember, it was only a little over a year ago, February of 2023, I believe it was, when the SEC issued its order sanctioning the LDS Church $5 million for violating the law in their reports to the SEC. There is an introduction here that will go over the details of that, so I won't go over them again now. But what happened was that in July, I think it was about July of last year, so several months later, a group called Faith Matters, which is starting to gain some prominence, it's a bit of a softer, gentler kind of Mormonism. And it's attracting a lot of people. They have conferences, they have get-togethers, they have a podcast. And in this podcast, they have two young interviewers named Tim Chavez and Aubrey Chavez. And they have a guest on their show. And the guest on their show is a man named Aaron Miller, who is a professor at BYU. I believe he's a professor of business ethics, ironically enough. And they're going to be asking him questions about the whole SEC and the Ensign Peak advisors account and all the issues related to that. And what the professor is going to do is try and give, I don't know, justifications, defenses, explanations on behalf of the church. So this is apologetics light, and yet it is still, I think, largely misleading in what it says. So we wanted to have our own professor come on the show. This is a professor of accounting at Indiana University named Spencer Anderson. He's been on the show before. He's kind enough to come on the show tonight and give us his expertise as we play some clips from the interview at Faith Matters. How are you doing tonight? Spencer Anderson, are you there? There he is. How are you doing?
Hey, how you guys doing tonight? Good to see you.
It's good to see you. How are things in Indiana?
Really great. There's a lot of trees out here and the buds are coming up on the trees. It's beautiful out here.
Oh, wonderful. That's great to know. Yeah. And how are things going with your new job? I know you moved there from Illinois University.
Yeah. So Illinois and Indiana both have great accounting programs. But I really like it here at Kelly. The Kelly School of Business is really fantastic, highly ranked, in accounting. And I've got amazing students here. So I get to talk a lot about accounting with students, and their eyes light up instead of their eyes glazing over when I talk to most people about accounting. Yeah.
Yes.
So it's a lot of fun. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad we have you here tonight to talk with us and to comment on what it is that another professor, Aaron Miller, is saying about the church and its finances. And I know you've gone over this already. You know, in large part, what you're going to be saying. So if we can play this first clip. Now, the first clip is a 1 minute and 55 second clip. It's just audio. It's the introduction to the Faith Matters show where they recapitulate what it is that had been going on and who it is they're talking to, why they're talking to him. So if we can play that, it's just 2 minutes. And if you need that refresher, here it is.
And I just want to note before we start, I don't know the exact circumstances, but just to help people kind of place who Faith Matters is, Terrell Givens played a very prominent role getting them off the ground, sort of as the original host of the podcast. And he plays a very direct role, whether on screen or behind the scenes with this podcast, at least in its origination. So
it's more under the umbrella of what we would call neo-apologetics, at least when they're doing their apologetics.
You got it.
Hey everyone, this is Tim Chavez from Faith Matters. In May of this year, the news program 60 Minutes aired a segment exploring the finances of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. David Nielsen, a former portfolio manager at Ensign Peak, the investment arm of the church, alleged that the church had been operating improperly as a tax-exempt organization and called for that tax-exempt status to be revoked. 60 Minutes also interviewed W. Christopher Waddell, first counselor in the presiding bishopric, who denied Nielsen's claims. Near the end of June, the Wall Street Journal published an article of its own, again emphasizing the size of the church's assets and the opulence of its temples. This is an issue with an extraordinary amount of complexity and significant moral weight. Though the church hasn't publicly disclosed the value of its assets, estimates place it at over $100 billion. Put in context, that's about double the size of Harvard's endowment, making the church one of the wealthiest religious institutions or non-governmental organizations of any kind in the world. The questions this raises are clear. How did the church acquire this much wealth? Is it reasonable to see assets of this size as a rainy day fund, even for a religion with a name attesting that we live in the last days? Is tithing simply God's money and a matter of faith alone? Or should members have insight and transparency into church finances and how their donations are used? And of course, what good could be done in the world with $100 billion or more? We felt like this was the right time to explore these questions on Faith Matters, and we brought on Aaron Miller to help us sort through some of them. Aaron is a teaching professor in BYU's George Romney Institute for Public Service and Ethics, where he teaches classes on business ethics and nonprofit structure and finance. Though he's quick to point out that he doesn't have privileged insight into church finances, he was able to walk through these issues in a really detailed but understandable way. And to us, he represented extraordinarily clear, objective, and open-hearted thinking on this subject.
Okay, so there's the introduction. Now, I do notice positively that they are treating this seriously, and they even said in the introduction that these issues about the church having so much money in their EPA account is an issue of significant moral weight, they said. So I think that's good that they recognize that and that they're talking about it in those terms. I did also notice that they said that, is it appropriate for a church to have $100 billion, it's over $100 billion, in the savings account, when even though its name attests that it is in the latter days? And I thought, well, yeah, but the name also attests it's supposed to be the Church of Jesus Christ. And I think that factors into it too. Do you have any comments, Spencer, before we go on to the actual video clips?
I mean, from a member's perspective, not from a financial perspective, this was something that I feel like I was missing when I was in the church, when I was still in. It feels like this is sort of the new age, unorthodox perspective, that the nuanced perspective that a lot of people are aching for. As we get into it, you'll notice that some of the details are a little bit off, that, as you said, like a lot of it is apologetic. Some of it is a little bit misleading. I think that Aaron's goal here, the professor, in the guest, his goal is to not necessarily muddy the waters, but to make it a little bit more of a complex issue than it really needs to be. And so his goal is to make it so that, because it's such a complex issue, I can then fall back on faith as an answer. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of the goal here. And I think that that's probably, if you just keep pushing and kind of thinking about your doubts and what and whether this is right or wrong, it doesn't take much to actually still come to the conclusion that this was an immoral act, right, that the church was engaging in. And then I just want to give shout out to Aubrey, and we'll see some of the questions that Aubrey had. She had, her questions were worded in such a way that you could tell that she was acting in good faith. She either had real, significant, serious, authentic doubts about the church's finances, or at the very least, I feel like she had taken the time to really understand those who were concerned and did have doubts about this topic. So, you know, she wasn't straw-manning the issue. You know, I feel like sometimes from the faithful perspective, the questions will be like, how can we bolster our faith enough that we can follow God's teachings to pay tithing, mm-hmm. despite our incorrect views about how the church uses its money? You know, it's just sort of this leading question where the answer is already set. And she didn't do that. So I appreciated that. So anyway, I wanted to give a shout out, despite the fact that, you know, we're going to go through some mistakes and errors in judgment here, and perhaps like, you know, fallacies, fallacious reasoning that we're probably going to see in the next hour or so.
Right. Well, Mormon apologetics, making the simple complex since 1830. This is about an hour long, their podcast. And the first part really is just going over stuff about the history of the church. For some reason, whenever the church wants to talk about, or defenders of the church want to talk about how wealthy it is now, they always want to talk about how poor they used to be, as if that's some kind of a balancing act, as if that makes any difference in the equation of whether they should be hoarding $150 billion and not doing anything with it to help alleviate suffering in the world. So they do that. We're not going to go over that. So we get about halfway through when they start really getting into the nuts and bolts of the issues. And the questions are asked, and then Aaron Miller, the professor, will give answers. If we can get that first video clip ready, we'll play that, and then we'll comment on it when it's done.
Yeah. Let's talk about a little bit about some of these numbers, at least where we've guessed, or there have been leaks occasionally. Uh-huh. So yeah, it's roughly, we think, $100 billion probably more,
yeah,
based on recent market conditions, maybe,
right,
that Ensign Peak is investing. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you're estimating that the church is collecting 6 to 7 billion, maybe closer to 7 in tithing.
Yeah. Or maybe as much as 8 is my guess.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay. But that's sort of the range. Mm-hmm. And then church expenditures, how much would you say those roughly amount to?
So what the whistleblower has said is that the church is essentially setting aside about $1 billion a year.
Okay.
And it's been doing it since the late 90s.
Okay.
And so it spends up to, until there's about $1 billion left, and then that $1 billion goes into Ensign Peak, where it gets saved essentially and invested to grow.
Okay, so Ensign Peak is growing through the profitability of its own investments, mm-hmm, plus this additional surplus that comes in through church operations.
Yep. Yeah. So if we're using an analogy, you could think of it as like a retirement account.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, if you have a 401k or, you know, or an IRA or whatever, you know, it grows based on the performance of its investments, but you also continue to put money in it, so it grows faster.
Yeah.
Okay. The first thing that I noticed was that he presents as not knowing anything. In fact, he goes into detail about how he's not speaking on behalf of the church, how he doesn't have any inside information. He's just talking as a professor who knows a thing or two about this subject in general. And yet, when Tim Chavez is saying the account has about $100 billion in it, Aaron Miller goes, probably more. And then he says, and they make $7 billion a year in tithing. And Aaron says, probably closer to 8, which I found remarkable. A person who claims to know nothing about the subject is correcting somebody else on their figure, saying they're too low. What do you make of that, Spencer?
I mean, throughout the podcast episode, they do this back and forth, where they talk about, well, what about this number? Or what about this estimate? What do you estimate, Aaron? And he'll give an answer, but he doesn't say where he gets the answer from. And so it's really interesting to me, because I think it's pretty obvious that there are two sources where they could have gotten this information. One is the whistleblower report, and number two is the widow's mite report. And neither of them ever get cited specifically, especially the widow's mite report. And we'll see even more specific examples where it's obvious that they have gone to the widow's mite report, but they just are failing to acknowledge. So, you know, if any apologists are listening tonight, at least, you know, cite your sources, because the widow's mite has gone through a ton of effort to come to these conclusions, to come to these estimates. And he just puts them out there as if like the church provided them or something, right? And so as if they're really easy to come up with, which isn't the case.
And in fact, Spencer, when he says 8 million, he goes, maybe even as much as 8 million is my guess. My guess. My guess means I did some research. This is the information I came up with. Here it is. In reality, he's lifting it from some other place. He's directly borrowing, as the church would like to say.
Yeah.
Right. This is all out there in the public domain now because of the widow's mite, in spite of the fact that the church has sought diligently to hide this information and in fact violated the law and got sanctioned by the SEC $5 million because they were trying to keep this information hidden so the public and the members would not know how much money they had in the U.S. stock market. Are you ready with the second one? Second clip there, Bill?
Yeah, I can put that up. And also, just to note, we covered this in the Mormon Newscast. By the way, folks, if you're a regular to this show, but you don't check out the other programs we do, we have the Mormon Newscast, which is a live news program we do on Monday nights on the same channel here, Mormon Discussion Channel. Radio Free Mormon and myself are part of the host of that, Rebecca Biblioteca, and from time to time, John DeLynn as well. Just a note, in the Mormon Newscast, we covered that the church's total accumulated wealth, their financial investments seem to be somewhere in maybe the, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I won't be doing my guesses, but $150 billion or so. But the actual accumulated wealth of the church at this point, I think, is around $265 billion when you include everything that they've got. Okay. You're muted, RFM, but
I'm not sure how much it is.
You're not sure
I'm not how much it is, but later on in this interview, it is made clear by Professor Miller that the amount totaled in the EPA does not include real estate.
Yeah, and the total I gave you, I think, does.
Okay, well, it's certainly more than whatever's in the EPA account.
Yeah.
And quite a bit more, because the church has a lot of real estate, 2% of Florida.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, I think that's really helpful to sort of get the lay of the land contextually, yeah. Historically, but also what's actually going on. Can we talk about the SEC?
Sure.
Fine, and yeah. Explain the accusation and the cease and desist, and yeah. let's yeah. Break that down.
So I'm not a securities lawyer, and I didn't when I was a lawyer, I didn't do securities law. So there's a lot of complexity here. If you are investing in publicly traded stocks, is anything you can buy like on the New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ or whatever. Generally, you don't have to tell people what you're buying and selling, unless you're buying and selling more than $100 million a year worth of securities. And if you're doing that, then there is a filing that you're supposed to do. I think it's called a 13F, if I remember right.
You remember right.
And that filing is just after you've done the trades, telling the public, hey, here's what we bought and sold.
Yeah, and the amounts.
Okay. And the reason is because somebody with that size of portfolio could be a market mover, meaning that yeah. they could with a single purchase shift the value of a stock in a dramatic way.
Yeah.
And so even if it's disclosed after the fact, the point is the public gets to know what you own and how much.
Okay.
Or what you trade and how much, I should say. And so the church, as it started managing this big portfolio, a sizable chunk of it was publicly traded stock, and trying to preserve the confidentiality of its financial investments, talked to some lawyers who told them, well, what we can do is we can attribute these trades to a smaller chunk of 13 different subsidiaries. They were still reporting all the trades, but they were breaking out across these 13 different entities. And the trading of those 13 different entities was not obviously tied to the church.
Okay. And they were all underneath the $100 million threshold. So they wouldn't have to file.
They were above it, but it was being broken up so that you didn't know that entity number one was being managed by the church. You didn't know entity number two was being
managed.
So the church was controlling these 13 entities, but not disclosing that to the public. And so Enzyme Peak was telling these 13 entities what to do with all these trades, but people didn't know it was Enzyme Peak telling them to do all of that.
So I would say, first off, that by and large, he got everything absolutely correct here, all right? Except for one thing, and that is that once again, Professor Miller, who claims to have no inside knowledge, he doesn't have any he has expertise, but he doesn't know what's going on. He's not on the inside. All of a sudden now, he knows that some leaders consulted lawyers, and it was the lawyer's idea to do this. And I found that remarkable, first off, because it's not true. And second off, because how does he know? You know, he's already said he doesn't know. All of a sudden now it's like he knows that there were lawyers involved. And this is where the apologist in him comes to the forefront, I think. And he's going to do this more and more in other clips, blaming the lawyers. Now, Spencer, what were your thoughts about this clip?
Yeah, I agree with you. So Aaron got it mostly right. He got all the facts right. I think we've gone into a lot of detail to kind of look at whether it makes sense that the lawyers might have been involved, but the lawyers weren't the impetus behind this action, right? Right. And so we'll see in a couple of clips here just how kind of he goes down this path that just makes absolutely no sense. It's conspiratorial. It's devoid of the facts. And so, yeah, this is just kind of setting up for his arguments down the road.
Right. And I want to go ahead and repeat here. We've said it. It's been about a year now. I think it was last July we talked about this last time. But if the church or anybody else had gotten bad legal advice and relied upon it to their detriment, that is a defense in an action or investigation by the SEC that can be raised during the investigation. The church never raised that as a defense to the SEC. And almost certainly the reason why they didn't raise it is, number one, because it wasn't true. And number two, because if they had raised it, then the SEC investigators could go to their lawyers and ask them if that were true. And the lawyers would say, no, it wasn't. So they never brought it up as a defense during the investigation. We also know that because if they had, it would have been written into the order that was issued by the SEC a little bit over a year ago. And it would talk about, they raised this defense and we investigated it. So they never raised the defense. What they did was they waited until the order was issued. And they said, we consider the case closed, paying the $5 million, right? $4 million assessed against the EPA, $1 million against the church. Because the SEC said, the church needs to pay $1 million because you were directly involved in this. They waited until the order was entered, the investigation was over, to start raising this idea that we got bad legal advice. And I find that to be in bad faith. So if we continue on now, Bill, we'll see how this develops.
So, and this is the part that was the most disconcerting to me, because I feel like I have so much trust that the church is ethical, and that there was nobody in a dark room making, you know, trying to get away with something or hoarding money for themselves and all the things that you see in actual fraud. And so I want to walk into this with some grace, but the thing that felt really shady to me is that there was such an effort to make, I mean, confidential feels like a really nice way to say hide it. It feels really shady that they were creating business managers I was reading in the SEC, the order for the cease and desist, that it said that they were looking for church employees who had very common names and weren't really on social media so that they could be the business managers for these LLCs. That just feels like so not the church to me. So tell me, is that normal? Is that like a thing that happens? Or does it seem shady to you?
No, because I was a lawyer.
Okay. So that's what I want to know. Yeah.
I absolutely can see why I feel shady. I mean, I see where that perspective comes from, because the immediate question everybody's going to ask is, if you're hiding something, why are you hiding it? That's the most, that's the obvious and immediate question. And having a background in business ethics, I see that's an instinctive and very rational response to ask. When you see somebody hiding something, your next question is, why are you hiding it?
Okay. So number one, of course, he says, that's a lawyer, right? It's a lawyer who did this. He has no idea if it's a lawyer. Now, lawyers were certainly involved, but the other side of it, in addition to what I've already said, that shows it wasn't just the lawyers doing this, right? Is the fact that the president or the operating manager of the Ensign Peak advisor's account was Roger Clark, with a silent E on the end, who wrote the book on investments. And he had been, he knows how to do this. He was the president during basically this entire 20-year time period when the EPA, when the church was filing false 13Fs and creating this entire structure with all these shell companies in order to hide the fact that the church had this much money in the stock market. Roger Clark knows you have to file 13Fs. In fact, we know that he knows that, not only because, duh, this isn't rocket science. This is very basic 101 stuff that you know if you're doing this stuff for a living, which he does. He had his own investment company running for about the same 20 years as he's the president of the EPA. And guess what? His own account that he was running filed their 13 Fs every time they were required. He absolutely knew exactly what was supposed to be done. And what he did was he allowed somebody who he thought was in a position of authority over him to persuade him to do something that he knew was against the law. And that somebody wasn't some podunk lawyer. It was a person he considered to be a prophet, seer, and revelator, and a person who speaks for God. Spencer.
Yeah, I mean, I even think that, like, let's just give him the assumption that there was a lawyer involved, which I don't think that there was. Aaron's response just blows me away, because he thinks that being a lawyer and his experience as a lawyer suddenly makes this action less shady. What about the commonality of this would ever have anything to do with whether it's shady or not? What would the fact that lawyers have a certain mentality or a certain reputation, what does that have to do with whether it's shady or not? And so when Aubrey, she has this real concern, it's very heartfelt, it does feel shady, and that's because it is shady. And she asks, is this normal? Is it the kind of thing that happens? Does it seem shady to you? And he says, well, no, because I was a lawyer, so it doesn't seem shady to me. What does that even mean? That just doesn't even make, it's not
it
a good argument.
It doesn't make any sense. Because let me tell you, as a lawyer, lawyers are actually held to a very high bar of ethics. And attorneys do not advise their clients to break the law. Okay, that's not, You don't do that. Why would you do that as an attorney? You've gotten a client that you represent, and you're advising them to break the law. This is not like some kind of nuanced way of challenging a tax code, or maybe trying to get some kind of benefit where the language in a statute might be ambiguous or susceptible to alternative interpretations, right? Lawyers do that all the time. That's fine. That's good faith. But telling your client to break the black letter law, okay? No, attorneys don't do that. And if attorneys did, they should be disbarred. And if attorneys did, the church would have told that to the SEC, which they did not. And if the attorneys did that, Roger Clark would have said, are you out of your mind? We're not doing that. We're not going to break the law. This is the Lord's church. We believe in honoring and sustaining the law, and we're going to obey the law. But no, he didn't do that. He compromised his own ethics in order to allow the church to continue to operate in darkness, as far as letting anybody other than this like group of five people at the top of the church who are in on the secret, letting anybody else know, including the membership, how much money the church had. And Roger Clark is on record as saying the reason they did that is because they were concerned if the membership knew, then they might not stop paying their tithing.
Go ahead.
Well, the two things I was going to share is, number one, what seems more rational to me is that the men in the room, top 15 or top three, along with the investment folks go, hey, you know, here's our fears. Here's what we're worried about. And then you can go to a lawyer and say, if we get caught, how does the law play out? What's going to happen? Okay, we can live with that. Let's do it. It seems absurd to think that lawyers on the front end are going to look for loopholes in investment loopholes. They're going to be the lawyers get brought in after the fact. That's the most rational thing. And then also just to note, this started under Gordon B. Hinckley. Elder Oaks is a lawyer, number one.
Mm-hmm.
Elder Eyring, we also got some word that Elder Eyring was personally brought into the 12 because of his expertise in sort of helping with this.
He was a professor of business at Stanford, I believe.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so just to note, there are men in the room, if he's going to say lawyers did this, there are men in the room who essentially effectively acted as that, as the top leaders of the church.
Yeah, either they initiated it or they knowingly went along with it. And that's why the SEC spanked him with $1 million fine against the church alone.
Yeah.
I do want to say, on the other hand, that Professor Aaron Miller did agree that the perspective of seeing this as shady, he said it was a rational response. So he's at least admitting that much, and I want to give him credit for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would say that it is somewhat common in financial reporting among companies to try and, you know, maybe they have trade secrets or maybe they have some new competitive advantage in their industry that they're trying to, that they don't want to publicize or anything like that. And so by divulging that kind of information, maybe they give up some of that advantage. And so the role of lawyers in financial reporting is often to make sure that they can lower their transparency, but within the law. I mean, I think that that's the key here, right? It's to the lawyer is there to interpret the law, to interpret securities law. And I just don't believe that lawyers would come in and say that this was keeping up with the law, with Securities and Exchange Commission 13F. So I think that it doesn't square with a lawyer providing this type of advice, because this is very clear what you have to do in order to comply with Reg 13F.
And I'll tell you, Spencer, I've been a member of the church for 46 years now, and I have been taught since I was 18 by the church to be responsible and take responsibility for my own actions by way of repentance of sins. I have yet to see church leadership ever take responsibility for their actions. Instead, when it comes to hiding information, like Joseph Smith using a seer stone, they blame the artists. There are rogue artists out there who are putting their pictures, unbeknownst to us, in our magazines and fooling our members into thinking that the translation process was done a different way than it really was. And now it's rogue lawyers. These guys, they refuse to take responsibility for their actions, and that does not tend to make me have a lot of respect for them.
As a believer, I always kind of, well, as a person who is kind of going through a faith transition, the problem with any of these arguments is that it always, the buck eventually does still stop with the prophets and with God, because the prophets are supposed to be directed by God to circumvent any of these bad, this bad advice that might be coming their way. You know, God's church is supposed to be protected from this type of thing. And so even if this is why I, even if the argument, even if I just grant them the argument that lawyers were the ones behind this, it doesn't work, because God should have intervened and stopped the church from doing something that was egregiously wrong, from breaking the law. He should have intervened and told the prophets what to do. So there's just never any way around that when it comes to apologetics. I think when it ends up being that anytime that you try and throw the lawyers under the bus, eventually, if you lead it to its logical conclusion, you're throwing God under the bus as well.
That's a good point. And I think Roger Clark gave away the farm when he said the reason the church did this was because they didn't want the membership to know how much money the church had. That's the motive.
Yeah. And one only need look at the church handbook of instruction to recognize how serious the church and God take financial malfeasance, illegal behaviors regarding finances, whether it be embezzlement or other types of financial frauds. By the church's own standard, the top leaders of the church should have went through a disciplinary court. But as you can see, the rules don't apply universally across the church.
I'm available Sunday night, and I'll get the subpoenas out in the mail.
Yeah. Can I deliver them?
Absolutely.
I'd love it.
That'd be great. Okay, so can we go to the next clip?
That doesn't mean hiding it is obviously dishonest. And this is where the lawyer part comes in.
Okay.
So one of the ways that lawyers manage risk is through opacity. They make it hard to identify assets. And the reason they do that is because the law allows them to do it to a great extent. And if you talk to any, for example, financial planner or estate lawyer, one of the tools in their tool belt is opacity. They make it hard for, like, let's say somebody wanted to sue you for, I don't know, some ridiculous amount of money because you bumped into their car, right? Mm-hmm. Fender bender, but they want to sue you for a crazy amount of money. Their lawyer, if their lawyer is doing their job, is going to try to find everything that you own to make sure that it's available to the lawsuit should they win. And your lawyer, prior to this, if they had done their job, would have done their best to make as much of that as opaque as possible, as much as the law allows, essentially. And so this is, I mean, I know this sounds like a cop-out, you know, we can get into the bigger questions about transparency around church finances generally. Once you start with the position that the church wants to keep its financial resources confidential, and then you turn to lawyers and say, hey, lawyers, can you help us do this? This was 100% lawyers being lawyers.
Okay.
And it's important to reflect on the fact that the church did not avoid any financial payments it owed. Mm-hmm. This is purely
everything
disclosure.
Was there, reported.
Yeah, there. Well, all the stock trades were reported, but also they weren't avoiding taxes. They weren't right. avoiding fees that were owed. They weren't trying to defraud the government out of money. So that's the first important yeah. point. There was nothing about this that meant they could avoid a payment that they owed to the government. Secondly, all of these trades were being reported to the public. It's just that the public didn't know that all these 13 entities were controlled by the church.
Right.
And they got some, you know, a couple decades ago, they got some bad advice from some lawyers doing what lawyers do to say, hey, we think we have a legal theory that justifies separating into these 13 different entities.
Yeah.
And so that's what happened.
That's what happened. The guy who doesn't have any inside information and goes to links to say he doesn't have any information. Now, not only does he know it's the lawyer's fault, but it was years ago they got this bad information from lawyers, and they've just been following it ever since. He goes through all the things that the church didn't do, okay? Notice he says twice that lawyers will try and hide your assets within the law. He said that twice, within the law. The problem is this was not within the law. This was in violation of the law, Aaron Miller. You know that. That's why you cleared your throat and you said, I know, uncomfortably, you looked like you were kind of on the hot seat in this point. And you also said, I know it sounds like a cop-out. Anytime somebody says, I know that what I'm saying sounds like a cop-out, it's a cop-out, okay? And I think we heard a cop-out from him. These were in violation of the law. He goes through all the things that the church didn't do. The church didn't, the church did report, you know, all their finances just under all these different shell companies, and they didn't avoid taxes. I mean, you could run that list forever. They didn't try and assassinate the president. They didn't try and take over the country. Yeah, that's not the issue. The things that they didn't do. The question is, and the issue is, the thing that they did, which was in violation of the law, which you're still trying to pawn off on the lawyers.
Did you notice?
Oh, Bill.
Did you notice that he did have a little slip of the tongue there, and he actually did admit that the church would have had to have come up with it first, and that the lawyers yeah. then said that they could get away with it. So, and then he wants to back off of that and go, no, the lawyers did this. No. If church leaders brought the plan to the lawyers, knowing that this breaks the law, again, you have a lawyer in the top 15, you have a business erudite from Stanford in the top 15, you have the people who have an awareness that, you know what, this is breaking the law, but I think we can get away with it. And they brought it to the lawyers. He admits that. And then he sort of changes the story. You got to hold to something, my friend, Aaron. You got to stick to a story, draw a line in the sand, and stick to your guns. You can't keep changing because people see that.
Yeah, you're spot on, Bill. I mean, I think that, like,
Andrew has to say, I will just say that. It is clear that Aaron came into this and he was going to blame the lawyers as many times as he could during this interview. That's what I'm seeing. Spencer, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, yeah. I was just going to say, Bill, you're spot on, because he goes through this reasoning that, like, well, lawyers like to avoid legal liability, and that's why they're going to get into this. You know, they're going to engage in opacity and things like that. But all of that argument, as Bill is kind of mentioning, is completely irrelevant, because the whole goal was originated not from lawyers. The church leaders were the ones that wanted to hide the information. It wasn't the lawyers that were saying, you know what, church leaders, you know, we really need to think about legal liability. You know, what if there are some frivolous lawsuits that come your way? It was the church leaders that went to the lawyers that said, we want to hide this. And so the whole goal behind this has nothing to do and can't have anything to do with frivolous lawsuits or anything like that. So, and, you know, if that is the reason, we now know that the church has a lot of money. And so frivolous lawsuits can come their way anytime now. So there's, you know, if his reasoning is true, there's absolutely zero reason for the church to not be transparent now. The cat's out of the bag. We know that the church has a ton of money. There's no protection by being vague about the finances of the church now. And so it just doesn't, the whole argument just falls completely flat. The other thing I'll mention too is that, number one, out of all of the things that are ethically wrong, the vast majority of those things are legal. So for him to like equate legality with honesty, you know, where he says, I know that, you know, it doesn't mean that hiding it was dishonest. And here's where the lawyer part comes in. It's so funny, you know, the whole argument in this area is comparing the church to like the lowest standards of legal responsibility, which the church failed to meet, by the way, and then compare the church to, you know, to these lower standards. So as a business ethics professor, I think that he would argue in his class, in any other circumstance, that legality is not the same as ethicality.
Legality is the bare minimum.
It's the bare minimum. That's right. And the last thing that I'll say too is that he said, you know, they made all their payments and all of the trades were available and reported to the public. But there are two problems with this argument. The first one is that the whole reason that these 13F requirements exist is, number one, not to report the trades just in general, but who is in charge of all of those trades. And they failed to do that. And that's important for the public to know, because then they know who the market movers are. And number two, not all of the church's trades were reported to the public, because we know since then that DMBA, a separate subsidiary of the church, was simply failing to report any 13Fs despite the requirement to report. So yes, Ensign Peak, through its shell companies, was reporting 13F was filings, but the DMBA was not, even though they were above the $100 million threshold. And so there's just a lot kind of, it's just really bad reasoning. And I think that, you know, it's the same as Bishop Waddell in the 60 Minutes interview. I feel bad for them because they're put in this position to like defend the indefensible.
I also am not persuaded by his argument about frivolous lawsuits. And I notice that he wants to go to some kind of fender bender lawsuit where it's a fender bender and then someone comes after you for an enormous amount of money. Okay, is that what's happening with the church? Are they getting sued because of fender benders, or are they getting sued primarily over child sex abuse? And you know that, Professor Miller, but you don't want to say it. I will also add, frivolous lawsuits get thrown out of court, okay? Frivolous lawsuit, you file a motion, you get it thrown out of court because it's frivolous. The church has enough money, it has its own law firm. They can handle the lawsuits and get them dismissed and take care of any frivolous lawsuits. It doesn't have anything to do with how much money they have. If the church has insurance, okay, you sue the church. If you get a recovery, it comes out of insurance, or they can self-insure and pay it out of whatever account they have. You don't have to have $150 billion in order for people now to start lining up and filing frivolous lawsuits. I think that's a phantom ghost kind of excuse that he's making there.
And I just want to note, you guys have been saying it all along, but I want to just say it differently. If church leaders got in trouble for doing something that broke the law, church leaders did something illegal.
I'll just let that sit for a while.
Yeah.
So what you're saying, if church leaders got in trouble for breaking the law, the church leaders did something that's illegal.
That's what breaking the law means. When you get your hand slapped, that you crossed a line that's been written out and you get in trouble, you broke the law.
Good point.
It's illegal.
It's illegal, and yet they are still the first presidency of the church, and nobody can do anything about it because everything runs from the top down.
I would wonder how one would do illegal things and maintain the spirit of discernment or the Holy Ghost or the light of Christ. It seems as though they would be void of those things, and yet from Gordon B. Hinckley till today, until recently, the church seems to have operated with leaders who had no problem doing illegal things and doing things that violated the law of the handbook as well.
It's a good point. Hmm. Definitely something to think about. Do we have the next clip now, Bill?
And, you know,
it turns out that was illegal. That's the point of this, of this whole complaint, right?
It was, yeah. And the church, you know, and I, my guess is that this was several years in the works. It wasn't just, you know, like SEC found out about it in January and then they settled, you know, however long ago it was now. I think what's more likely is that, what's much more likely is that this was like an ongoing investigation, negotiation, back and forth. And the $5 million agreement was a settlement, you know, where they basically said, church said, we're going to stop fighting this. We'll pay this fee. We'll admit to wrongdoing because what we did was not legal.
Not legal.
Boom. Boom. Not only does Tim Chavez say at the very beginning of the clip, Professor Aaron Miller agrees at the end of the clip that what the church did was not legal. So I want to give him kudos for that. Any thoughts from the two of you about that before we go to the next clip? Professor Anderson?
No, that's great.
Yeah, it's already been said.
Okay.
Yeah. So you mentioned that lawyers like to do this because it helps them manage risk. What do you mean by that in this context? Like, what's the purpose of hiding these trades? Yeah.
So a lawyer is going to be like looking over their shoulder.
Yeah.
In every situation. Yeah. Right. There's a degree to which you can't predict legal risk. You don't know what's going to happen or who's going to do what, or what, you know, undertrained volunteer is going to mess up on your behalf and now make you legally responsible for their screw up that you're now on the hook for with a big lawsuit. Mm-hmm. These are the kinds of things like lawyers that do this kind of work. They're paid to see ghosts, essentially, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. To look for any potential risk that they could find. An organization with large resources is always going to be a target for litigation, even if it's really kind of like sketchy reasoning to justify the lawsuit. That's always going to be happening too. And lawyers that work for entities the size of the church are just constantly, I mean, they're paid to be paranoid mm-hmm. about that yeah. kind of thing so that they can cover every eventuality.
So once again, he's blaming the lawyers. And, you know, it strikes me that I think that even with this argument that Professor Aaron Miller is making, he's tacitly admitting that the church is not run by prophets, seers, or revelators. It's run by lawyers. What do you think, Professor Anderson?
Yeah, I mean, like he says that, you know, lawyers can't foresee the risks and you have to pay them to see ghosts. And I thought that the church was run by other people that were allowed to see ahead and see around corners and were paid and not paid, but that were able to see ghosts. And so I just found the wording very interesting. Yeah. It turns out that it's the lawyers that are asked to see ghosts and not the prophets.
Right. The prophets are supposed to see holy ghosts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What you're going to say, Bill.
Yeah. But the same idea that they're the ones who claim to talk to spirits, including Jesus Christ himself, right? They're the ones who claim to talk to entities on the other side of the veil. And as Spencer said, the phrase that they use, they see around corners. They teach the truth. Prophets, seers, and revelators are the lowest sort of human being walking on the planet. They're the ones who are manipulating, covering up child abuse, claim to talk to God, but seem to never really have the answers when they're needed.
If I can be clear, let me just suggest that when this order came out, the SEC order, the same day it came out, if not before, all three of the first presidency, Presidents Nelson, Oakes, and Eyring, should have resigned from their positions.
They should have.
That's what I would expect to see in any other organization. Mm-hmm. But they did not because they know they're untouchable.
Yeah.
They can do whatever they want. They can break whatever law they want, and there's nothing that the members can do about it. And the only thing that makes it more goading is that they tell the members to follow the law, which they are not willing to do themselves, apparently.
Yeah. So one last thing that I'll mention too from this perspective is that whenever faithful people talk about this issue, they tend to bring it down to a secular perspective. They say, well, this is the way businesses work, and this is the way lawyers work. And whenever people that are critical about the church talk about this issue, they try and remind everyone that this is supposed to be the church led by God and by prophets. So it's just really interesting that to me, that from a faithful perspective, this is the one instance, the one area where suddenly prophets are incapable, we have to rely on lawyers. You know, don't even mention the prophets have nothing to do with this. Don't talk about God's involvement in this or anything. There's no inspiration in the church anymore. It's all based on hiding legal liability because we can't know what's going to happen in the future. It's just really odd. Like all of a sudden, whenever we talk about the finances of the church, it's like all of a sudden, this isn't the Church of Jesus Christ. In every other situation, it is. And so it's just kind of an odd
juxtaposition.
It's a contrast.
I agree. And once again, for the second time now, he makes the analogy about frivolous lawsuits, as if the only kind of lawsuit that can ever be brought against the LDS Church is frivolous. That's what he said both times. He's never acknowledged any kind of good faith lawsuit with any merit behind it.
And as your point, as you're pointing out, RFM, first off, that's a distraction. But beyond that, the church has already said the reason for why they did it. We don't have to propose a frivolous lawsuit reason for why. Church leaders have already told us that the reason this was done was to hold tithing numbers back from the members and the general public out of fear that tithing would go down. They never said it was about frivolous lawsuits. They gave you the reason, Aaron. You don't have to give another reason. Just go with the one that's sitting there right in front of you.
Right. Are you going to accept the reason that Roger Clark and the church gave themselves, or are you going to make up new excuses to try and cover their ass for them?
Amen.
Next clip.
So church ended up settling this with the SEC, paid a fine. I can't remember how much it was. $5 million?
$5 million.
Okay. Yeah. So drop in the bucket.
Well, compared to his total resources, my understanding is it was a right-sized fine if you were to compare it to similar, you know, violations of the law.
No, actually, I don't know what a right-sized fine is. Is that a term of art, Spencer? Have you ever heard that before, a right-sized fine?
Yeah, I don't know. This is hard to like even gauge because, first of all, there are only, what was it? I think three or four companies that have been dumb enough to make 13F violations in the history of 13F violations. And so I don't want to say dumb enough. I don't know. But it's a very uncommon thing. So it's a very small sample size. But 5 million versus the normal fines for this were like around like 15,000.
Yeah.
And so that's quite a difference. On the other hand, to his point, and to be fair to him, this was 20 years of obfuscation. This is, over 20 years of 13F violations. And so, I guess it would add up to maybe the right size would be if you accumulated all of the 700,000 or 7 million omissions that they made in those 13Fs, then you could probably get to 5 million. I don't know. I don't know what the calculus was behind the decision of 5 million or anything like that.
But I think the point you make is good, is that in this comparatively small sample of companies that have been sanctioned for filing 13Fs inappropriately, they're not defrauding. They're not grabbing the money for themselves. They're just defrauding. Well, I want to be careful when I use, they're violating the law that requires them to let the government know that they actually do have all this money in the stock market. Okay. So the SEC is required to know that by the law, and they violated that for 20 years. Other companies who have been sanctioned for doing the exact same thing got substantially less of a fine. Like you said, around $15,000 or $50,000 compared to the $5 million that the church was sanctioned. So it's a huge fine. It's by far the biggest fine in history against any organization for a violation of this nature. Is that fair to say?
That's right. Yeah. And my suspicion is that the reason for that is because the church was knowingly engaging in these violations. Whereas a lot of times these are, you know, sort of born out of ignorance or born out of neglect. It's not something that is so nefarious as to like create all these shell companies with mailing addresses and with people that answer the phone and, right. And so there was a lot going on to engage in this sort of violation. So that's probably why.
And then I just want to throw up as anecdotal data. One of the things that happens here is there's a negotiation between the church and the SEC, and the church is going to do everything in its power to reduce the penalty that it pays. And it has power and influence to do that. It has politicians, It has other avenues. It has all the money in the world, obviously. It has avenues to influence. This was a Reddit post from 5 years ago. Andrew Bustamante was a former covert CIA agent. And somebody asked the question here, are there any secret societies or powerful people that have huge influence on the intelligence community? Okay. He says Texas A&M and the Mormon Church, and that's not a joke. So I just want to note, that in a negotiation, a extremely powerful entity has ability to influence how outcomes turn out, much more than if Mormon Discussion Incorporated had suffered this penalty and these guys were screaming down our throats. It would be a very different game. I would have no bargaining power at all. The Mormon Church, the LDS Church, has power and influence out in the world. It has the ability to negotiate in ways that most entities could never even get close to.
Any thoughts about that, Spencer?
I mean, I don't know. I don't have any personal information I'm privy to here, but I do know that the church threatened to sue the city of Cody, Wyoming. Basically sue them to bankruptcy if they about kept fighting this fight about the temple. And that's kind of a microcosm of kind of, I think, what Bill is speaking to is they've got a lot of money. They have a lot of members that are everywhere in the SEC. You know, there are definitely people, BYU grads at the IRS and, you know, places like that. And so, yeah, I mean, to what extent they can influence those people or to what extent they do, I don't know, but they certainly have the ability to.
Very good. Do we have the next clip ready to go?
Does that also mean that as it stands today, we could look at some filing and see what trades the church is making?
And it's been going on for a couple of years now.
Okay.
So Enzyme Peak has been reporting since 2019 or 2020. I don't remember exactly when that started, but Enzyme Peak has been reporting instead of across the 13 entities, Enzyme Peak.
And they got caught.
Under just that one entity.
Okay. So we can't see the asset base, but we can see trades that are made.
No, I think it's the portfolio, if I remember right, and in pub, but it's only the publicly traded securities. So it's only going to be stock that is sold, bought and sold on like the New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ.
That's interesting. So we could see how much the church essentially has in stocks and publicly traded securities.
Yeah, and it's about $45 billion.
Oh, is it $45 million? Right. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So the other
billion
between 60 and 100 is real estate. Mm-hmm. And
well, I'm not sure real estate actually counts in that bucket.
Oh,
so the 150 billion might be a small number.
Okay. That's part two of this. Okay.
Yeah. Because a totally separate legal entity manages the church's real estate, if I understand it.
Right. Oh.
Did you see the look on Tim's face when his eyes went to the side like that? Holy crap. At the end. Yeah. And it wasn't the 45 million. It was 45 billion. Even though Tim incorrectly said 45 million, it was probably just a slip of the tongue. But no, 45 billion now in the stock market. And all of a sudden now, Aaron, who doesn't have any inside information, knows it's not 100 billion in the EPA. It's closer to 150 billion. Notice how that suddenly just shifted during the course of the conversation. Even the title of their episode has to do with $100 billion question, right? No, it's 150 billion. And where did he get that information from, Spencer?
Yeah, I mean, of course he got it from the widow's mite. I can't think of any other place. I don't know of any other place where all the work has been done to create this estimate. So I know the church isn't providing it.
No, and I wanted to play that clip also so that we could have Aaron Miller admitting might be too much of a word, but admitting that the church's real estate is not included in the $150 billion in the EPA account. That's when Tim's face went, what?
Yeah. And I think that they were talking over each other or misunderstanding each other, because either they were misunderstanding each other or at the very least Aaron's wrong about that. So EPA does control the real estate, the for-profit real estate arm of the church.
Oh. And so the real estate is included in the EPA $150 billion amount?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So then I had that wrong.
He had it wrong.
Yeah, that's why
he
had it wrong.
He was the one that was saying that it's separate. And it's not. So like if you think about, you know, the EPA universe, it's about, as of end of 2023, Widow's Mite estimates that it's around $182 billion. $182 billion. That includes all of what's under the purview of EPA, and that includes all of the for-profit real estate. Now, it doesn't include like temples, chapels, those types of things, okay, as far as I'm aware. So it would include, you know, the BYU endowment. It would include Ensign Peak, which includes, you know, both equity and debt instruments. It would include, you know, private capital ventures, things like that, as well as real estate.
My eyes are glazing.
Sorry.
Can I ask a question here?
It's just, it's really important to know exactly how it's all broken down.
No,
maybe,
you're right.
Maybe that's not for anybody
you
else
on the show.
It seems like you're trying to explain it, but it's something I've always been confused by, is I keep hearing this, you know, 40 something billion dollar number here, and I keep hearing the $150 billion number, and some people are walking away thinking the church only has $45 billion. So by the way, the other thing I wanted to say was that in the comments, people are noticing that multiple times, it seems like the folks involved in the conversation that we're sharing here sort of slur billion and million, and aren't really saying it clearly, almost intentionally. The last one seemed like a slip, but there, people are noticing that it seems like it's intentional to sort of muddy billion with million.
Yeah,
but there's that.
Elder Bednar did that at the press conference, didn't he?
I don't remember offhand, but
yeah. He said million, and then they went back and they changed it on the long shot, and they had his voiceover going $1 billion because people called him out on it.
But maybe Spencer, I know you're sort of speaking to it, but can you explain? People are getting confused about that 40 billion something, that 150 billion. Can you just say, you know, why, what that number represents and what that number represents?
Okay. So Ensign Peak is the investment arm of the church. It has around 180 billion of assets. Within that 180 billion is 40 billion in public stock. And that's, those are the ones that we, that they have to file a 13F for. So in total, if you think about all of like the non-church stuff that the church owns, that's all under the umbrella of Ensign Peak, and it's 180 billion of assets and investments of lots of different kinds, 180 billion. Now, if you add on top of that 180 billion that the Ensign Peak owns, you get it, you add an extra 83 billion or so, which is the church itself. So the church itself, like the ecclesiastical, the theocracy or whatever you want to call it, that's only 83 billion worth of assets. Ensign Peak is 183 billion.
So is the church itself 83 billion or so in addition to the 180 billion in EPA?
Yes.
So everything the church owns, church stuff, private stuff, everything in one kitty is about $260 billion. Is that correct?
Yeah. 265 at the end of 2023.
That is more than a quarter of $1 trillion.
Yeah.
That's a lot of lunch money.
Yeah.
It's enough lunch money to pay for free lunch for every kid in Utah into perpetuity. Wow. If that's what you're talking about.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
Next clip, Bill.
Okay.
I think it's really helpful. I like what you said, that there, when you see that something is being kept hidden, then you have to ask why. And, and I think for me, it was I had a more emotional response to the fact that it was deliberately hidden. And so this is helpful to understand, because that was my knee jerk reaction that, oh, this wasn't a mistake. This was something, this was a deliberate decision. And so those little details about the business manager and the addresses, those mattered to me, because it was like, this wasn't something was overlooked. But
this,
I think,
is a creative lawyer actually. So, you know, one of the ways we can help prevent this being traced to Ensign Peak is if we can get people that have pretty unremarkable names. So if you do a Google search, they won't turn up. I mean, that's a lawyer. That's a creative lawyer.
I appreciate that. Yeah. I appreciate that perspective.
I feel like
he's starting to get really, really nailed here by Aubrey, who is telling him exactly how so many people felt. Apparently she felt this way too. She's saying, this is not a mistake. This is not an accident. This is deliberate. The way they set up the shell companies, the way they had different addresses, the way they had different people who were in charge of each of these shell companies, and the way they picked people who had very common names, so it wouldn't show up in a Google search or have any kind of high profile or searchability on the internet. And what does Aaron Miller do? He goes right to the lawyer excuse. And I think that was maybe not his best moment in this interview. What do you think, Spencer?
Yeah, this is hard to hear. Again, like, it's possible that the lawyers were the ones that came up with the weird plan after being asked to do it, right? But the whole reason that they did it was because the church leaders wanted to hide it, not because the lawyers were trying to avoid frivolous lawsuits. So it just doesn't, the whole argument is, it doesn't work from the very beginning. We already know that it can't work. Yeah.
Yeah, he is contradicting himself with his excuses. I agree. Bill?
Rogue lawyers, rogue artists. It's always someone rogue out there who's just vile. You know, the church leaders want to do the right thing. They do. You know, they've never hidden anything. They always teach the truth. But damn it, every time something goes astray, there's always somebody rogue besides them to blame. Maybe, just maybe, it's those top 15 guys who have been hiding history for 200 years, cutting out pages of letter books, putting things away in vaults, claiming that nothing's ever been hit. Maybe the buck just stops with them, and maybe they're simply just not what they claim to be.
Let me say maybe the same thing in a different way. The problem isn't rogue artists, and the problem isn't rogue lawyers. The problem is rogue prophets. Next clip.
So talk about why, though. Let's talk about the why something should be hidden. Like, what does the church have to lose by just being completely transparent? Because it feels like that's the call everybody's asking for, and maybe most especially the youngest generation of adults is asking for transparency and expecting transparency and getting transparency in most other contexts of their lives. Yeah. So does this work? Is it going to keep working to just to be so, to keep everything hidden?
I don't know. I'll get more behind that answer, but I don't know. I mean, the reality is there are definite pros and there are definite drawbacks to keeping things confidential. I mean, and I'm pretty confident the church leaders know this. I don't think they're naive or stubborn about this. I think they're all very smart and incredibly successful and capable people. And so I'm sure they're weighing these things in the balance, and probably more often than we realize is my guess. I will say this, the pros of it are risk mitigation. And, you know, when the total assets are not known, it can discourage a lot of bad behavior by outsiders who would want to take advantage of or threaten the church. You know,
not true.
The cat's out of the bag as far as that's concerned now. Mm-hmm. Like, I think the church benefited for a long time with risk mitigation by people not knowing how much the church actually had in assets.
By them hiding it.
Now that that's known, maybe that advantage goes away. Even if it's not known in detail, it's known in broad strokes.
Since when do you get to call risk mitigation? Like, that's the phrase you use, but what you're really saying is deception and dishonesty.
Yes.
Yeah,
exactly. By the way, when he said it's not really known, but it is known in broad strokes, I thought that was a tacit admission to the widows might having it right. Did you think the same thing, Spencer?
Yeah, for sure. I thought that it was interesting how suddenly the church leaders were competent. So before, they had to rely on lawyers. They didn't really know what they were doing. And then he said, you know, they're really smart people. They know what they're doing. They're not being stubborn about this. I'm sure that they understand the trade-offs when it comes to transparency. Why couldn't they make that trade-off 20 years ago? Why couldn't they have foreseen this, right? This is kind of you can't argue both sides of this.
Yeah, even if we're not in the religious realm, in the prophet realm, in the Holy Ghost realm, these guys are very successful in business. They're very intelligent. Apparently, they just have a problem with ethics. I think that's the only thing that they lack. Do we have the next clip, Bill?
Yeah, but before we do, yes. RFM.
Oh, yeah.
Hello, friends of Mormon Discussion.
Hello, friends of Mormon Discussion.
I'm Bill Real.
I'm Bill
Founder
Real.
And CEO.
Founder and CEO.
Reaching out to our incredible community. Our mission.
Our
is
mission
to support those is to examining support the truth, examining claims of Mormonism, the truth,
claims of Mormonism,
and those redefining and those their relationship
with our acclaimed lineup,
our acclaimed lineup of podcasts,
including Mormonism Live,
Radio
Live,
Free Mormon,
Radio Free
Mormon Discussion,
and others
offers a space,
offers
for truth,
a space for truth
and healing. But we need your help.
Your donations
power our work,
expanding our outreach,
expand, improving our content, and creating new initiatives. Visit mormondiscussions.org, click the donate button, and make a difference today. Donate to your favorite show, like this one, as your support empowers us to empower others. Thank you for being a part of the change. Together, we're making real impact. All right, now we can do it. Sorry about the echo, folks. Whenever I have a screen share with the audio turned on, that will always happen. Apologize for that.
People will be inspired to donate twice as much now.
I would hope so. We won't blame the rogue artist or the rogue lawyers. So
it's the rogue tech people.
I think this was before the amount was known. A lot of people have opinions about what should be done with that money. And if people don't know how much the money is or how it's managed, then they're less willing to second guess your decisions.
Yeah.
We're seeing a lot of second guessing happening now, where people are constantly asking, like, why isn't the church doing this or this or this or this, knowing that they could, where before they might have never, it might never even have occurred to them.
So in other words, it's okay to deceive the membership about how much money you have, because if they know, they might think that maybe you should do something with it to alleviate suffering. That's the excuse I'm getting from him here. He's got a whole list of excuses. Some we've heard before, some he's come up with himself. I'm not hearing a lot about taking accountability and being like Jesus and doing the right thing and obeying the law. All I'm hearing is a litany of excuses from the professor about why it is that hiding stuff and breaking the law to do it is okay. Spencer?
I don't have anything to add to that. That's great. I mean, everything he said was true. Like, he's just, you know, he's basically saying, like, this is the, here are some of the reasons, you know, if you get to control the narrative, you get to go off on the side of and tell people that you don't really have all this money. You know, you get to tell people in Africa that, you know, we're not a wealthy church.
Yes.
But we give what we have. Or you get to give people this impression, you know, that you are the greatest humanitarian organization in the world, which I hear see on Facebook comments all the time. You get to control the narrative when nobody knows what's behind the curtain. And so he's right. Like, that is one of the benefits of non-transparency. Who gets to receive that benefit? The church does. And so I don't really understand why we would be arguing for that, right? Especially if it leads to nefarious action.
When you say you're not a wealthy church, and again, that's a, by the way, folks, that's a real quote that church leaders used in order to give off the idea that we're not that wealthy, but we do a lot in the world. They, when you say you're not a wealthy church, when in fact you are among the top, if not the wealthiest church in all of this country, right? Like, it's not like the Southern Baptists have got this much money. I don't think the Methodists are doing this good. I don't think the Jehovah's Witnesses or the Scientologists are doing that great. Mormonism financially is elite. They are at the very top.
And they have said that on a number of occasions before this came out, maybe even since it came out, but they try and portray themselves as a relatively poor church in order to accentuate the value of what donations they give. Because if they're poor, and they give a certain amount, let's say $20 million, right? That's huge. That's amazing. That's Christ-like. But if you've got $150 billion in the bank and you give $20 million, now it's looking like chump change.
Yeah.
Next clip. We're trying to move along through these as quickly as possible. We still have a few left to go, but they're all good.
The cons are obviously a lack of trust. You know, transparency... you know, and this is speaking from an ethics standpoint, transparency is not necessarily itself an ethical good. It leads to other ethical goods, right? It discourages bad behavior, that kind of thing. There's actually interesting research by a scholar named Dalen Kane who found that in some cases, increasing transparency actually leads to less ethical behavior. It's called the sunshine effect. And when people feel like they've disclosed, now they feel good about engaging in conflicts of interest because they've told everybody they're doing it.
Oh, interesting.
And so I mean, transparency on its own is not necessarily an ethical good. Now, you could make the case that there are, or you could argue that you know, church members have a right to know what the church's finances are, and you know, that'd be interesting to discuss. But the idea that what transparency does, though, is it leads to, in most cases, ethical good, which is it discourages dishonest, fraudulent behavior. And that's where I think it's worth reflecting, because there is thus far zero evidence of that, right?
Yeah.
Of church resources being abused for personal enrichment. That, by the way, would be illegal as far as the IRS is concerned. It would cause huge penalties and potentially even cause the church to lose its tax-exempt status if there was substantial personal enrichment happening. But we don't have evidence of any of that. And the whistleblower, nobody has ever come forth to say, like, hey, here's the secret Corvette.
Right.
That this general authority is hiding from the public that he bought with tithing.
Yeah.
It is pretty remarkable. So.
Is it a strange thing, Spencer, to argue on the one hand that there's no transparency in the church, but also to say, hey, it's okay because there's no evidence that there's been any abuse of the lack of transparency?
Yeah, right. How would we know? This is the dumbest. I hate this part because I wish that they had edited this part out of the podcast. Because I think that if we asked him later, I think he would say, you know what, actually, this was not the best argument. Because I know about this study, by the way, that he's mentioning, this sunshine effect.
Tell us about that.
It's based on moral licensing. And moral licensing just means that when you get yourself as a person, if you give yourself good points for doing something good, then you feel more justified in being able to do something bad, turn it around and do something bad. That's the gist of moral licensing. But in what other domain would we ever say do less of a really good thing? Because otherwise you might feel good enough to do bad things. So better avoid exercise. Or because if you exercise, you might eat some sugar afterwards. Don't cheat on your spouse. Don't be faithful to your spouse, I guess. Don't be faithful to your spouse, because if you're faithful to your spouse, you might feel okay about lying to your boss. Like this is the line of reasoning that he's giving. It's just not a good argument. So whenever you talk about the downside of transparency, these are second order effects. The broad benefits of transparency are way outweigh any of the downsides. And I think he sort of acknowledges that at the end.
Yes.
Where he says, yeah, it does lead to ethical behavior for the most part, but
in almost every
instance, in every instance, I don't understand why the church would be an exception here. And in fact, it's not an exception. We've already seen that it's not an exception. We've seen that the church suddenly has ramped up its humanitarian spending once it was forced to the transparency table. So this is, he also makes the argument at the end. He says, we don't have any evidence of any of this. And what he was referring to before is he's meant unethical behavior. But we do have evidence of unethical behavior by the church because they were being non-transparent. They were allowed to do that. That's kind of what transparency is trying to circumvent. So one other thing too is, you know, it's interesting when you say like, okay, well, we trust the church in this one area, even though they're not transparent. Well, there's a 2015 study, an accounting study, that found that companies with charity status have a 60% higher prevalence of accounting errors than for-profit entities. And so you would think, you know, that that not-for-profit entities are very on the up and up compared to for-profit entities, but that's actually not the case. Like, you shouldn't trust companies just because they're a not-for-profit or just because they're a church. They actually have, 60% higher likelihood of accounting errors than for-profit companies. And the reason for that is that they can take advantage of the trust that people inherently have in them. And the second reason for that is that because they're such misers with their money, because they're not-for-profit, that they don't dedicate the resources that they should to internal audit functions, to a good financial reporting system, to being transparent with their constituents. All of these things that cost money, they go cheap on, because they're not for profits or they're churches. And then they end up, you know, being susceptible to fraud because they don't have good internal controls and things like that. And so to argue that the church is somehow not going to get a benefit from transparency is just ludicrous.
He sort of argued, you know, again, I totally get this. On one hand, you're admitting that these guys aren't transparent, but then you're saying, like, what's the problem? It's not like these guys have Corvettes or whatever. But folks, if you don't know how this all works, I mean, I dare these men to step forward and say they've never gotten a free car, that they've never gotten transportation provided by the church, that they don't fly first class on the church's budget, that they don't have the best insurance in the world to the point where they all seem to live to be in their 90s, late 80s, their 90s, their hundreds, their children or their grandchildren get free education at the church schools, that these men who are supposed to be not well off, I'll give examples, Thomas S. Monson and Boyd K. Packer, who both came through very meager lines of life. I think Boyd K. Packer worked for the Deseret News, if I'm not mistaken.
He was a CES man too.
Yeah. And Thomas Monson, I forget what he did, but it was something very meagerly as well. But when these men die, they all have 3, 4, 5, 6 houses. They have tons of wealth. If you think for a second, all they get is that meager stipend of $130,000, which isn't meager to begin with.
Which is probably closer to $200,000 now.
By now. These men accumulate significant amounts of wealth over the course of their time in the church. And when they die at significantly old ages because of the care that they get, these men often have way more wealth than what their line of work said they should have accumulated.
I'll just make two more observations. First off, about moral licensing. I hadn't heard that expression before, but thank you for introducing me to that, Spencer. An example of moral licensing might be that if you're the head of a church and you are sustained and believe that you are a prophet, seer, and revelator and have a direct pipeline to God, that you might think that because you're that good and that righteous, that it's okay for you to defraud the federal government and file false 13F claims in order to hide how much money you have. Would that be an example of moral licensing, Spencer?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So if you think you've done good in one area, you give a blessing to a widow, you can turn around and on the way home, smoke a joint or something. I don't know.
Yeah. The other thing was, Aaron has tried to blame lawyers, lawyers, lawyers. I want to bring up for the record, there are two internal accountings that were done in the church. And two of them, I think it was 2012 and 2014, something like that. But there are two of them done separately that both remarked on this issue with the SEC and with the 13Fs and said to the church, this is not a good practice. You're going to get in trouble if you continue doing it. Did they listen to their internal accountants? No, they kept doing it. So much for your lawyer argument.
Yeah, and his argument about personal enrichment, I mean, has anybody seen Joel Osteen or Ken Copeland? They have not-for-profit church entities, and they have plenty of personal enrichment, much more than the church leaders appear to have. And so the idea that, by the way, that would be illegal, the law is so squishy there that it's really not, it wouldn't be a problem. And then the other thing, to Bill's point about the salary thing, even if you do like just accept that they only get, you know, $150,000 a year, $200,000 a year, that $200,000 is basically off the top of all of their other expenses that are already paid for completely. Basically. So imagine that you have a salary, and then on top of that, whatever you have in terms of discretionary income on top of everything that's paid for, your housing, your food, your education, your travel expenses, your clothing, insurance. All of those things are paid for. Your insurance, that's a huge deal right now. You pay, that gets all paid for. And then on top of that, you get $200,000. That's what's really kind of, that's closer to what is going on here. And so, yeah, that would make you rich pretty fast if I had an extra $200,000 to stock away every year.
Good point. It's a pretty sweet gig.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Next clip, Bill.
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
I mean, I could speculate about it.
Yeah.
But I mean, I will say this, you know, and this is based on math I've done. If the church stopped collecting tithing, first of all, which is one of the arguments people have made, why do you need tithing if you have this? Can we just run the church on the growth of this endowment? I don't think the church would, I think the church would run out of money if it did. And I say that in part because the investment returns would exceed what's coming in tithing in the short term. Those would shrink if we had a crash like 2008.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Most nonprofits saw their financial resources shrink by, or their endowments, I should say, their savings shrink by somewhere in the order of 20% just within a year. I mean, it's a huge drop in size, and it took a long time for those to recover. The church is growing very, very quickly in what's known as the Global South. These are parts of the world where the tithe payers there are being heavily subsidized by the church's finances at headquarters. If we want, you know, like the church's growth in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, is kind of crazy right now. And those are people who need in their religious worship all the benefits that the rest of us enjoy. They need chapels to meet in. They need temples to receive endowments in and get married in. And that's continuing to grow. And I won't be surprised if we see a point where, because of the growth of the church in the Global South, we see the figure flip, where instead of a $1 billion surplus each year, the church is operating on a $1 billion deficit that's being pulled from its endowment. Wow. So, you know, how much is enough? I don't know. I mean, God knows. I believe that.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't surprise me if in his wisdom, this resource is built up for things to come.
So God knows that this is enough. This is basically his argument. It is enough because the LDS church is doing it. They're led by God, so it can never be too much. And now he makes an argument that actually the church could not perpetuate itself indefinitely with no more income based upon the reserves it already has. You heard the argument, Spencer. Do you think that argument is made in good faith?
No, or at least it's made out of ignorance, because, you know, he made this argument that, you know, what he wouldn't be surprised if it flipped, where suddenly the church was dipping into the reserves at $1 billion a year. Well, you know how much the reserves grew last year? $25 billion. So I think it'll be fine. I think it'll be fine if it dips, if it, you know, flips, if it ends up having $2 billion more in expenses every year. That's a perfectly fine argument. Yes, the Global South would have to be subsidized by other tithe payers or by Ensign Peak, but Ensign Peak has plenty to cover that and more. Just let me put it this way. Let me give you a couple of examples. So if the church was three times the size that it is right now, it could take Ensign Peak's assets, sell them off, and just turn them all into cash and just sit on the cash, no interest or anything. And it could keep going without any tithing, no interest whatsoever. A church three times the size that it is right now, it could go on for 10 years that way. 10 years for a church
that's three times. It could go on for 30 years right now? The size
it could go for, the size that it is right now, it could go for 30 years or more without any interest, without any tithing for the next 30 years.
Just off what it has.
Also, just off what it has.
Also, Aaron was talking about the phenomenon of a recession like in 2008 and how that might impact things. What do you have to say about that, Spencer?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if he's expecting a 35-year recession, but, you know, the 2008 recession, yeah, it took a little bit to bounce back. It took about, you know, 3 or 4 years to bounce back. And now the church is fine, right? So, like, this is not, it has 130 billion cushion, 180 billion cushion. They're just, it's not a logical argument. Because yes, it does bounce back, right? So there's just not there's no logical argument behind this, any of what he's saying. So it's funny how suddenly the numbers become very vague when you don't want to engage in the actual analysis. But like, when you look at the actual numbers, the church has enough money to operate into perpetuity without asking for another dime of tithing, if it just feeds off of just interest. And that includes the taking into account inflation, that includes taking into account the Global South being subsidized. That includes, you know, you could actually kind of, you could build 1,000 temples without even dipping into Ensign Peak. So this is just, the argument is just devoid of the facts.
I was talking with Colby Reddish about this earlier today, and he was talking in a different context about divine command theory, which is the idea that two basic different ideas. That there is a law, irrevocably decreed even, by which God himself is bound, right? That's one idea in Mormonism. But there's another idea in Mormonism, which is the divine command theory, which is that whatever God commands is right because God commands it. And we see that in the happiness letter from Joseph Smith, talking about what is right under one circumstance may be an off. Actually, what is wrong under one circumstance may be an off and is right under another circumstance. And it depends on what God commands. So that's the divine command theory. I see what Aaron Miller is saying here is tapping into the divine command theory, which is that if God commands that the church have $180 billion in the bank, right? It's always going to be the right number. And there's always going to have to be excuses to explain why it's okay for that to happen and not to have any outlays to help alleviate suffering in the world. What do you think of that, Bill?
Yeah, well, I agree with you. I just want to put up a comment on from the live comment, from the live chat. Philip Cook, who I think is, again, excuse my language, but a shill for the church, says, Mormon Discussion, Inc., that's if it continues to operate the way it does. It is likely to increase spending as time goes forward. This is all speculation. First off, Philip, the church has consolidated expenses. It's the reason you're cleaning the shitter every month and a half at the church, because we no longer have.
Come follow me now.
Yeah, it's one come follow me. It's why we got rid of a high priest group and now we only have an elders quorum. It's why there are ward buildings being closed all over the place, and they are moving more members into one building, into smaller stakes. The last 20 years, what the church has done is cut cost. And the church is no longer growing. Now, they may say they are, but they're no longer growing. Again, thanks to the Widow's Mite and some of the reports that have come out recently, we see significant decline in active membership, at least by the indicators that they show. So, Philip, what you just did was give a straw man response that doesn't actually hold up to any sort of real rational conversation. Secondary, I took my calculator that I do all the accounting for Mormon Discussion on, and I put $150 billion, and you guys correct me, you guys are way better at math than I am, but if I took $150 billion and I just stuck it into a good CD today, you know, just stuck them into a bazillion banks, all FDIC insured, into CDs that are collecting right now, a good bank is offering you about 5% interest. $150 billion at 5% interest.
Wisely invested.
Is seven, and there's no risk in a CD, FDIC insured, $7.5 billion would simply be the safe interest you would earn on a cash deposit today of your $150 billion. I think it's plenty to work on. I think they've got enough that maybe people shouldn't be cleaning the bathrooms anymore.
Spencer, what do you think of Philip's argument if you were paying attention enough to remember it? And now,
sorry,
there you go.
Sorry, I think that's a fine argument to make, Philip, but in the model, so the Widow's Mite model, they take into account the fact that probably spending will increase because the Global South is growing. Globally, and especially in the first world, the church is shrinking. But in Africa, the church is growing. In the Philippines, the church is growing. In, you know, a lot of these places that don't have internet, ironically, the church is growing. And so, so yes, that stuff does need to be subsidized, right? They need chapels, they need temples. That is taken into account in the model. And so, you know, I would encourage you to go to Widow's Mite report, just Google it, and you can kind of dig into kind of how the model is made and what kind of assumptions are made into it.
How much, he wants the follow-up question of how much should they have in reserves?
Not well, this much.
No.
This is way too much. This is obscene, yeah. Philip. This is obscene. And if you are defending it, then you're barking up the wrong tree, pal, because I'll let Spencer answer the question, but they've got like eight times as much as is even way more than they need in reserves. Go ahead.
Yeah, when you think about cash reserves, a lot of companies or a lot of, you know, not-for-profit entities have about 6 months of cash reserves, and this one has about 30 years of cash reserves, and so it is quite obscene.
It'd be 60 times more.
Mm-hmm. And so I actually appreciate the comment that, like, I don't think that, like, we should. If we were in a scenario where it was like the church was within some reasonable range of having reserves, then people could quibble. And I think that, like, we could come to different conclusions and agree to disagree, but we're just so far beyond that range. We're just so far in the extreme, the church is, in terms of how much it owns. It's it could buy every single NBA team today. It could own every single NBA team, the Utah Jazz, the LA Lakers. It could buy all of them with cash. So it's just a little bit, I don't know like what the right example is to use to like really convey how much money that it has, but it's the largest not-for-profit entity in the United States.
It's also the largest landholder in Florida. It's also buying up land all across the country. It also owns multiple media outlets, newspapers, TV channels. It owns lots of agriculture businesses. It owns lots of industrial businesses. It owns so much stuff. You can't even as somebody who has explored that, you can't even comprehend how much in holdings the LDS Church has. It is, as my dad would say, it is unfathomable.
All right. Well, we've got four more clips left. Just want everybody to know that we are approaching the end here. The next deals with the moral dilemma that many members of the church are facing now that word is getting out, thanks to the widow's mite, about how much money the church has in its stockpile.
Can I add one thing, though? I really like that Philip's asking these questions. Like, I think that's awesome. Because, like, a lot of faithful members, they wouldn't be, I'm assuming that he's a believer, but, like, that's awesome because like a lot of people will just make these claims without any evidence to support them. Push back on us because the widow's mite has the evidence. We have the facts in front of us and you can go to widow's mite and you can look at it yourself. So good on you for asking the questions. I think you should push and be skeptical. I hope that you'll push and be skeptical on both sides of the issue.
Graciously done. Next clip.
I think that brings up maybe what is the most difficult for a lot of people who are learning about all of this is that there's sort of this new, for some people, I think they're really experiencing an actual moral dilemma. Yeah. And maybe they really do believe in the law of the tithe, mm-hmm. and that this is a commandment from God and it brings blessings. And you want genuinely to obey this law. And at the same time, this is a human and a divine institution. And yeah. If we were handing over our 10% to God, that wouldn't be a question, but it gets complicated when you have imperfect, fallible leaders who are really good people, but fallible because sure. they're human, deciding where those funds go. And I think for some people, they're experiencing this real crisis of conscience and trying to decide, is it ethically wrong for me to give my 10% to something that some people are calling a hoard? Like, this is a big sacrifice for a single family, but like, is anyone really going to feel the benefit of this 10%? And would it be more beneficial to give this to a literally hungry child who's suffering today?
Yeah.
With, you know, like, would that be better? Would God prefer that that's where we put our 10%? And can I tithe that way? So I don't know. What do you think? Like, how do you reconcile? Or I guess not, it's more of just a wrestle. Like, how do you feel like this is something that as individuals we have to kind of figure out in the church?
Yeah. So that's an interesting question. And I think actually it's going to be mostly Latter-day Saints in the United States or other developed countries who experience it, but in particular the United States, and I'll say why. We get to deduct, well, depending on our taxes and whether or not we do a standard or itemized deduction, we get to deduct donations from our taxes, all donations to charity. And so I think culturally in the United States, we see tithing as the same as a donation to an organization that does good in the world.
Yeah.
I wouldn't expect that you'd see that in a lot of other parts of the world.
Really?
If you look at people who are faithfully paying tithing in other parts of the world, they have a different rationale. It's not, I'm giving this money to do good for the person who needs it. Their rationale is I'm paying tithing because it's a way to give it back to God as a form of gratitude and worship.
So I'm not sure why he's drawing a distinction by these rationales. I don't think they're necessarily legitimate anyway, because I know when I was paying tithing in the church, it was under the same rationale that he says is not U.S. centric. It's that God gave me everything I have and he asked for 10% back. And that's why I would pay 10% back. I think that's largely why members everywhere, including in the United States, give and pay tithing. So I don't think there's a sharp distinction. And I'm not sure why he goes there, really, because I'm not sure that's really addressing the question at the heart of the issue. What do you think, Spencer?
Yeah, I agree. I've never heard of this argument before anyway. I just, it's an interesting argument. I would love to see data that would suggest that people who are donating to churches outside of the United States see it as less of a charitable act than people within the United States, is what he's arguing. And the reason that he's making this argument is he's basically throwing, now he's throwing the Constitution and the IRS under the bus, saying that, well, it's the problem is that the church has this tax exempt status and you're getting a tax deduction. And so I don't know if he's trying to make an argument for taxing the churches. I'm all for it. So if he wants to make that argument and he wants to say that, you know, this is the downside of, this is the cultural output of having churches be given a tax exemption and for our donations to churches being tax exempt, then I guess, sure, yeah, I'm all for that. Thank you. Let's start the petition.
If I'm following his argument and I'm trying to actually follow it, it's almost as if he is saying that members of the church in the United States, they think that when they're paying tithing, it's going to humanitarian aid. It's going to a charitable purpose. And so they're the poor saps who are being fooled by this, because really it isn't. It's just going into a hoard and a stockpile. So I'm not sure why he's bringing it up. It's like he's saying the people who are dumb enough to think that this is really going to charitable purposes are the ones who are at fault here.
Yeah, I think Aubrey's real concern is not, you know, where is the money going or why, or my expectation about, it's not a problem with me. Her concern is that shouldn't the Church of Jesus Christ, shouldn't, if I want to follow Jesus, if I want to pay money to Jesus to show my devotion to him, shouldn't I give it to an organization that is doing something that I would expect Jesus would approve of? And so her real concern is with what the church is doing with the money. He's saying, well, maybe your expectation shouldn't be there. Maybe your expectation should just be that this is a fee to be a member of the church.
It's the fee to get into the celestial kingdom.
And I just want to add, so in developing countries, we already know they're not given the same narrative of church history, of church doctrine. They have a different book they use, you know, different manuals they use. We already have evidence that they go into these countries and manipulate the people into thinking it's a poor church. Number one. Number two, here in this country, in America and other developed countries like England and Denmark or wherever, wherever the church is in developed countries, it has what it calls a bishop storehouse. Person comes in, they're having a hard time. Bishop sits down, and however long that person needs it, they get free groceries. They get assistance with their bills getting paid. In developing countries, it doesn't work that way. They're, because the church is able to leave those people hanging and not help them and not suffer the backlash for doing that, that's exactly what they do, to the point where Robert Rees and other good-natured Latter-day Saints have created a charity, which is, I forget what it's called today, but it used to be called the Liahona Foundation. And what they would do is go, look, the church does a great job with its bishop storehouse and bill assistance pay from bishops to members in developed countries. But in third world or developing countries, the church doesn't use the bishop storehouse at all. It leaves those people hanging. They can maybe get assistance for a week and then they're cut off. And these are the people who are in deep poverty. They have children who are literally going hungry, and the storehouse isn't a real thing over in those countries. The church doesn't use its funds to help them in the same way it does folks here. And the folks who are not well off over there are much worse off than the folks who are not well off here. The church is not doing some great good in the world. It does some good, but it's such a small percentage drop in the bucket compared to the total money that they're bringing in. And I just want to note how much good, real good in the world, clean water, vaccines, healthcare, you know, feed starving children. How much good in the world could you do with $265 billion? It's a hell of a lot.
In this next clip, Aaron's going to talk about tithing as an act of faith. But interestingly, he's also going to talk about the fact that he's wealthy enough that he can also, on top of paying tithing, he can donate and does donate to various charities. The interesting part to me is that what he will tell us is that before he donates to charities, he does his due diligence and investigates the charity and makes sure that the money he's donating is going to actually help people on the other end. Do we have that clip ready? It's about a minute long.
And so this is my, this is a way for me to exercise faith in God and gratitude and worship, is to say, hey, you gave me this 100%. I'm going to give you back 10% to do whatever you see fit to do with. In addition to that, I also make donations to other kinds of organizations. And we, and my wife and I do that. We have regular charitable donations that come out of our bank account every month, organizations that we've chosen carefully because the nature of their impact, the data backing up the quality of their impact. And so we make sizable donations to charity on top of that. We're fortunate that we can. I wouldn't even presume to say that everybody should do that if they can't afford it financially.
Did that have the clip in there where he talked about that?
Unless it's the next one, I don't, that's where it cut off.
Do you have that? I'm glad you had the whole thing pulled up, Bill. And if you could go to that place here, and let's make sure, because I'd hate to leave that out. That was supposed to be 49.27 to 50.10. And if you could go to like 50.00.
Yep, give me 1 second. 50.00. I'm going to actually, let me move this over.
And hopefully I'm not misremembering this. But you saw this too, remember, Spencer? You saw it, we talked about it.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, good on him for giving to charity. I do agree that paying to the church is not giving to charity, obviously. I will say that, like, he does make this allusion before in the clip before that about, like, deducting your tithing. And that's why we think of it as charity. But most people in the U.S. today take the standard deduction. I think he's wealthy enough, or maybe he's taking an itemized deduction, and so he's seeing it as tax deductible and therefore equating it with charity. But yeah. Most people are paying tithing. Most people in the U.S. even are paying tithing without any tax benefit.
Yeah, I think the standard deduction for a couple filing jointly is like $27,000. And you can drop off bags and bags of clothes at the Goodwill, pay 10% of your tithing, and do a few other things over the course of the year, and you would never get close to that.
Right. That would be like if you're making $270,000 a year, right?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be the tithing on that?
Yep, 10%, right.
$27,000. If you have that, Bill.
I do. So let me
see if we can find this.
Yep.
Donations to charity on top of that. We're fortunate that we can. I wouldn't even presume to say that everybody should do that if they can't afford it financially. But what I would say and encourage, I guess, anybody who's, and I've had students come and ask me the exact question you're asking, is that the purpose of tithing is it's an act of worship before it's ever an act of.
You can go ahead and stop it. Philanthropy.
And what you're saying is that
I must not have gotten the right clip on that part, but it is in there. Trust me, because Spencer's my second witness. And in the mouths of two or three witnesses, what, Spencer?
Yeah. Yep.
Will every word be established? Absolutely.
We are God's. We are God's now today, tonight.
Okay. So let's go to this next clip. We're almost to the end. And this is a place where they're questioning. How many? Okay, this is a good place. And I wanted to include this because I think this is a good spot for them. It's getting toward the end. And Aaron is acknowledging that people who question how the church is using its money, i.e. maybe not using its money, but anyway, how it's using its money and they have doubts about it, that they their faith should not be questioned any more than a person who says, I just donate 10% and whatever they do with it is fine. I think this was an important part to conclude the conversation on. And I think this is one of the best parts of the entire interview.
And can I just say before we start it, this church originally instituted tithing with the definition being surplus or interest. The church has manipulated the definition over time in order to get 10% of gross out of most of its members that are active, temple attending, you know, the folks who want to be both feet in. And now they've accumulated more money than they were supposed to based on changing the definition of tithing and have stored it away almost entirely as a rainy day fund that even when the rainy days come, it never uses.
Yep. They didn't touch it when COVID hit.
No, it grew.
Yeah. So yeah, if that's not a rainy day, there's no such thing.
Right.
That I keep thinking about how you're talking about these are both expressions of faith, and I can see how someone putting their heart on the altar might look like, okay, I'm going to like honestly ask myself if I'm doing the right thing. Like yeah. that could really be an expression of faith for someone. Absolutely. And for others, it will look like I trust and yeah. this feels right to me, and you could burn the money. And I appreciate that both of those perspectives, like we'll be incapable of telling if someone is really expressing faith by the way that they pay tithing. And yeah. I think that's a really beautiful reminder.
Love and that. I think it's good to not have one group get away with criticizing the other unfairly. Yeah. I think the people who get mad at the questioners are saying that they're just hurling criticisms, you know, and that's obviously not the case. And the inverse is true. I mean, to criticize the people who are very just faithfully and simply saying, hey, I trust what the leaders are going to do with it. You know, the accusation of them might be that they're naive or foolish. And yeah. I think that's unfair.
Any thoughts about that? I already said what I had to say at the beginning. Spencer?
No, I agree. I mean, that was very gracious of them. It would be nice if, you know, I would love to see more of that in the church where that kind of attitude where you don't have an orthodox perspective. You know, I admire people like Jana Reese who have chosen to give their tithing to other entities. And I'm sure that that's a very difficult decision, but I think it's a very faithful decision from their perspective. Like their faith isn't in the church. Their faith is in God. And from their perspective, they're following God by paying tithing to some other entity. And, you know, there are benefits to that too. I would add, Jana Reese mentioned how when she chose to pay tithing somewhere else besides the church, she suddenly had to think for herself about what her values were and where her money was going to go that would help people the most, that would be the most Christ-like destination for that donation. And so for her, like that was like a growing experience for her. And so, yeah, I'm happy that somebody that probably does pay tithing, has it taken straight out of their paycheck maybe, is willing to acknowledge that there's another way to see it.
Bill?
Yeah, just somebody noticed here, I mean, during COVID, they increased the monthly rate that families pay for their kids serving a mission. So while their rainy day fund grew another $20 billion, the amount that a kid pays to go on a mission went up $100 per month. And, you know, again, we all understand cost of living goes up, there's inflation, groceries cost a lot, totally. But recognize that that's within an institution who had surpassed inflation by significant amounts. They made more money than they lost through inflation. Like they did fine. And yet they put the burden on the families even greater.
I think they put a hiatus on the increase during COVID, but the point is still the same.
Yeah, I thought, yeah. And that's what I had remembered is that they had announced it. There was backlash and they said, okay, we won't do this right now. Is that right?
They should have done a survey first and checked and seen what the people were going to say.
I mean, they would have done it except for the backlash, right? Because they said, okay, well, I guess this isn't a good idea to increase the rates. This last clip that we have, Aubrey, who's been my hero in the interview, now all of a sudden gets passed. It seems like she feels like the professor has answered her questions adequately. And now so they start talking about how long it's going to be. And I think it's 30 years at present rates that the church is going to end up with $1 trillion, right? And now it seems like Aubrey gets sucked into it and thinking, wow, $1 trillion. Imagine how much good we could do with $1 trillion. And when I say sucked into the trap, I mean the idea of always thinking that however much money you have, even $180 billion, right, is not enough to start doing good with. It's always going to be when you have more money. And that's part of the trap that people can fall into. I think that's the trap that she falls in. I'm not sure. But go ahead and watch the clip and you'll see what I'm talking about.
I was watching the YouTube videos about what's the difference, like how big is a trillion versus a billion versus a million? Because it really is mind-boggling. It's mind-blowing how much bigger a trillion is than 150 billion. Yeah. But also it's exciting because the restoration is still rolling forward, right? And we're part of this. And is this how our generation is going to continue building out what the restoration actually looks like? And so I wonder if you could just talk about, can you imagine what we could do with $1 trillion as a church? What kind of good in the world could we actually do? Whether that's partnering with people who are already doing good things or starting something new or continuing what we're doing, you know, what could that vision look and like for the next, what did you say, 25?
Yeah, about years? 25 years.
Okay. So about 25 years. Any comments on that, Spencer?
Is this the last one? Is that what you said?
This is the last clip. Then we're going to go to that one page from the Widow's Mite, and then we'll be done.
I mean, why not question what the church could do with $150 billion, right? So in the meantime, while the church is growing to $1 trillion, children are dying, people are starving, you know, vaccines are, you know, in poor areas are not being administered. There's all sorts of good that could be done in the meantime. And so why wait for 20 years? And then we expect that at that point, that's when all of God's love will be unleashed. And that's when suddenly all the good will be done. Do we have, I mean, it just seems a little bit
optimistic,
too optimistic.
with an accumulated,
devoid of the evidence that we have at hand. Yeah.
Yeah. With an accumulated wealth of $265 billion, the church chooses to spend like 1% of it on humanitarian aid. Where in the hell do you think that when they have $1 trillion, they're going to go, hey, all right, we got it. That's it. That's all we needed. Now we're gonna spend 30% a year. Guys, you're lying to yourself. But they're not going to do that much more. They're doing this thing where they're doubling the amount that they spend every year. We'll see if 20, 30, 40 years from now, because at some point that exponential growth is going to bite you in the rear end. They won't do that forever. So they'll change that at some point. This thing is going to hoard wealth. Because often the leaders come as the descendants of the past leaders, and this thing wants to have a large chunk of accumulated wealth to be able to work with the same bloodlines through all time and eternity. I have no trust. I told you guys this last time we had the three of us on talking. I don't believe for a second, this is me sharing not anything necessarily fact-based, but I think it's based in rationale, which is, it's hard to believe a church leadership only in an effort to protect the church's wealth would break the law. It seems like when people break the law, they do so for personal benefit. And my inside hunch is that by making billions and billions and billions of dollars, there is a personal benefit to the top 15 and their descendants who come after who also take on church leadership. And again, can't prove that. But I just don't believe these guys did it out of the goodness of their heart to break the law for the church to accumulate wealth. That makes little sense to me.
Okay. And speaking of this fact that now they're up to about $1 billion a year in humanitarian aid, we have a slide from a recently released Widow's Mite report. In fact, I think it's the most recent thing that they've released. It went up over this weekend. It's just going to be page 2 from it. Because what it's going to show in graph form, and we're going to have Spencer explain it to us, is that from the point in time that the Widow's Mite started exposing how much money the church has and the church has started taking criticism for it, that has coincided with a marked increase in the church's donations to humanitarian aid. Let me know when you have that, Bill. There you go. Spencer, can you explain this to us?
Yeah, so first of all, to set the setting, like, for a long time, the church was claiming that around 40 million had been given in humanitarian aid over 20 years or something like that. So it wasn't very much. It was like 40 million in over 2 decades. And so we think about, you know, what that actually means for a huge organization like this. Well, in 2021, around 2021, when, you know, all of this information started coming out, estimated charitable expenditures, which includes fast offering assistance, church welfare, things like that. Total expenditures went from 906 million to 1.36 billion, which might not seem like a huge increase, but in particular, faith-blind aid. So what we would normally think of as humanitarian aid, it's given without regard to whether you're Mormon or not. It's not fast offerings. It's not Bishop's Storehouse.
That's in the green graph at the bottom.
It's in the green graph at the bottom. Since 2021, that has increased by about 5 times. It's doubled, and then it's more than doubled since then. And it includes, you know, around $500 million in goods given and cash donations given in 2023. So $500 million. You might say, yes, from two things can be true at once. On one hand, it's still very, very little compared to what could be given. But on the other hand, the ramp up has been extraordinary compared to what it was 20 years earlier. And there's one event that happened that, in my mind, explains all of this, and that's that the church was forced to the transparency table by the whistleblower and to some second effect, the widow's mite as well. And so this is what transparency does. This is the effect of transparency. We all know it. This is kind of the result of it, is in three short years, humanitarian aid has increased by 5 times. So that's great. Good news, right? I mean, like, I don't care whether it comes from the church or whatever. Kids are being fed. Blood is being donated. All that stuff. So good.
So thank you to David Nielsen. Thank you to the Widow's Mite people for the transparency that you have forced upon the church. Once again, it seems that the church needs to be shamed into doing the right thing. But I agree with you, Spencer. I'm just glad that they're doing the right thing, regardless of the reason. And hopefully they will continue to do more of the right thing. Your thoughts, Bill?
Yeah. There's no way to be rude about the fact that humanitarian aid has gone up to some degree exponentially over the last few years. I hope that that pace continues, because they could afford to do a lot more. They have the money to do it. And just holding that money for some possible day, decades and decades, if not centuries into the future, not really knowing, again, we can pretend they're prophets, but not really knowing what the future holds. We could be on the back end of a world war. We could see economic collapses. We could see anything and everything. When you don't know what's coming, you absolutely should save enough to be able to have a rainy day fund, for sure. But you have so much money that you could do real tangible good in the world today. And I think there's a balance there. But as we pointed out, you are so egregious in one direction that you are missing out on an opportunity to really be a true and living church with which the Lord is well pleased.
Thank you. So let's open the lines. We'll take a few phone calls here. We've been going for 2 hours, so let's try and keep it short here on the back end. I don't want to limit anybody's time, but go ahead and give us a call, especially if you have a question for Spencer Anderson or a comment that you'd like to make. The number is, there's a lot of sixes in it. There's a couple sevens and maybe a two.
Yeah, I think it's 662-667-6667 or 662 Mormons.
Yeah, 662. There it is. Now I can read it. 662-667-6667 or 662 Mormons. Give us a call if you want to join the show. Bill's checking it out right now, yep. Seeing who's calling in.
And we've got, I believe it's Edward. Edward, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
You're on Mormonism Live.
So first, I wish I had a question for Spencer, but he's done such a great job. I just want to say thank you for you and what the Widow Mites have done. And this is actually a big topic for me because of how I call it the corporation has behaved, but I went to the church for, I don't know, about 5 years. I never bought into it from the first time the elders talked to me and told me the story of how Middle East people came over here. I say, well, if you darken my skin, I might look like an ugly version of Robert Downey Jr. in Tropic Thunder, but I'm not going to look like a Native American. Like they, I always say things that I don't hear from you guys. And one of the big things is for me is there is responsible churches out there that do good things. Mm-hmm. And if some of the things that you guys have said, like maybe getting, maybe using one penny of everyone's tithing dollar, is irresponsible, and if all churches behave like this, and this is what I believe, like our founding fathers wanted, is regardless of if a church is true or not, they're helping people. This organization is not helping people. And that's so I was sad when John Larson left the team, but I said, I sent him a text and said, you know, John, like I need to stay here for a bit because of the irresponsible way that they're handling things. And it's just this topic was a big topic. And I have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, guys. It's going to be 11 o'clock before I get up. I got to get up at 4, but I couldn't go to sleep. I had to at least call in and make a comment, but
thank you.
But Edward. Yeah. And, I just wanted to say one thing about, you guys shows, love them. And RFM, the only version of, Shakespeare I've ever seen was Conscience of a King on the first, Star Trek series, and I'm looking forward to learning a little bit about him. It's actually inspiring me to do my own shows. Like, I'm going to do a show on the relevance of DC and Gene Roddenberry Creates Magic the second time on Next Generation, but you won't watch that. But anyway,
I might watch it just because you're doing it, Edward, but there would be no other reason. I would do it for you.
Thanks, Edward.
Thanks for calling.
One more thing I wanted to say, RFM, is I'm going up. I live in New Hampshire, and I'm going up to see the eclipse, which I think is the only time I've ever seen it before was when I was a little kid. But yeah, we're going up there. But anyways, I just wanted to end it on a light note because just...
We're good. We're a nice close because Jesus is coming. I mean, he is. I don't know why you're laughing.
That's well, because what does God need with a starship, RFM? Like, yeah, why do they need all this money? What does God need with a starship?
But, because he's going to be paving the streets of heaven with gold.
Edward, all right, sir. You guys are doing a great job.
Thank you so much, Edward. Thanks for calling. Please get some sleep.
All right. And then the next one here says 423 Mormon. Is that the name you want to go by? 423 Mormon? Hello?
Florida Free Mormon?
Florida Free Mormon? Is that what you said?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead, Florida Free Mormon.
So I just wanted to bring up a few points in regard to the show tonight. So number one, in regard to engaging the attorneys. I really believe that, yeah, the church, you know, had their motive, and I'm sure that they did reach out to their attorneys and ask for advice. And part of the advice probably was the setting up of these multiple LLCs in order for them to be able to stay under the threshold. However, one thing that needs to be brought up here is the money actually had to be transferred from Ensign Peak to the LLCs in order for that to work, and then also had to be separately managed, separate from Ensign Peak. And that's where it didn't happen. And my guess is the church did not follow the proposal that the attorneys may have presented to them. So that's item number one. And then with that, obviously, they go out and they get these common name Mormon employees who they basically set up to sign fraudulent SEC forms, which I think is complete BS. And can't believe that the church would actually engage in that behavior. Then in regard to the SEC order itself, you know, the church can put out all their press releases, the apologists can come on and give all their excuses, but that's all noise. The SEC order is actually a document that the church and the SEC agree to, and it cannot be disputed by law. And with that said, basically, the church is admitting to what is contained in the SEC order. And as far as I'm concerned, that was the tipping point for me, because certainly there is no church that can claim that they're led by Jesus Christ that would engage in that behavior. And certainly not the Jesus Christ that I was raised in the Mormon church to believe in, nor the Jesus Christ that I actually do believe in now. So I am very disappointed in this regard, and I have a very negative feeling right now in regard to any organized religion, and just I really feel that the Mormon church has failed a lot of people in regard to the actions that they've taken, and I think they have frauded a lot of people along the way.
Thank you very much for those comments.
I tell you, I don't know if we work.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Nope, go ahead.
I'm not sure if we captured it in the clips, but there's a place. Excuse me, I've got to clear my throat. Almost completely over what I've had. Anyway, it's either in one of the clips, or if you go back and watch that show at Faith Matters, there's a place where Aubrey says that when she heard about this, she's going, this is not my church. This is not my church. And I want to say, Aubrey, that's the problem. This is your church. This is your church that did this. And of course, that's kind of what she means when she says, this isn't my church. Like you said, this isn't the church that taught me all these principles and taught me about what Jesus would do. This isn't that church. No, this is some other organization that has actually now been revealed as doing what it does. And it's not the church we were trained and raised to believe the church is. That's true. This is what the church really is and what it tries to hide from its members that got exposed in the SEC order.
Yeah. Yep, good point.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for calling.
You bet. Yeah, thank you.
Mormons Free Florida, whatever your name is.
Mormons Free Mormon. Florida. On the verge of a copyright infringement.
Okay. He's right. Like if it would be much more plausible if the lawyers had set up these entities independently and they had their own managers, that would have been legal. It still probably wouldn't have been ethical in from my perspective. You should be transparent with your members. You have they have a right to know. But at the very least, that would have been the type of advice that a lawyer would give. So that was a great example.
If the different office managers of the shell companies were actually managing the money.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. We didn't even get into that tonight, which was there were so many facets of this deception that talk about major planning and organization in order to carry it out, and deception on every level, picking people who didn't have a large social media presence, picking people with everyday names that you wouldn't be able to pick out among other names.
And naming the shell companies these blah, blah names that would not raise any antenna, alarm, any question about it being related to the church.
It was a multifaceted deception.
On every level.
Yeah. Okay. I believe this is maybe Clark. Let me see if I can.
We got one more call.
Or... Last caller. Yep. Clark, is that you?
Yes. My name is Stephanie Clark, and giving you a call.
Gotcha. You're on Mormonism Live. What can we do for you?
Oh, thank you so much. We really appreciate your reporting and everything that you do. And I definitely needed to hear this as far as just getting an understanding of what was actually going on. So I really do value your reporting. But I do have a question, and it's rather naive. Okay. So on one hand, what's so bad with the church becoming really, really wealthy? Okay, so if you think about it, governments are really, really wealthy. We have really, really wealthy billionaires who do a lot of bad stuff. So on one hand, wouldn't you kind of rather have the church have that money? Like if somebody's going to be the wealthiest organization on the planet, like, okay, so there you go. That's my question. Why not the church?
Yeah,
I can take a stab at part of it. Spencer, yeah. I've been talking a lot, but you're the guest. Why don't you go ahead and address this?
No, I was just going to say, it's not a horse race. You can be mad at the billionaires that waste the money. You can be mad at the government that wastes the money. You can be mad at the church that hoards the money.
Right.
None of this is, a competition. And so, yeah, go ahead. I don't know if RFM had where yeah, that was,
I was just going to say that, that once again, a natural tendency is for us to immediately go to talking about apples and oranges. Okay. And there's only one orange in the world that claims to be the only true and living orange on the face of the earth. And that's the LDS Church.
Okay.
Which has Jesus Christ at the head and prophets, seers, and revelators who receive his will and implement it, right? So when you have that one church have $150+ billion just in an account that is not doing anything except sitting there and growing and growing and growing, that's what made me understand the passage from the New Testament where Jesus says, you cannot serve God and mammon. For either you will love the one and hate the other, or vice versa, you'll hate the one and love the other. You can't serve them both. So right now, for me, this has helped me understand the truth of what Jesus said. Because right now, the LDS Church has fallen in love with serving mammon. And because of that, they can't serve God. The fact they have so much money means that they're not using it to help people out, which I would think would be the prime directive for any church that really does have Jesus at its head and prophets and apostles governing it. That's my take. What do you think, Bill?
And
Stephanie, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, absolutely. Fair enough. Fair enough point there. What about maybe the thought that that when the Savior comes again, it is his earth, ultimately. He's the creator of it, and he will have dominion over all of it. So on one hand, would it be him that's, rendering unto Caesar that which is Caesar's? I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there. And, I do agree with you, Bill. I mean, thank you again. And I appreciate your thoughts.
Hey, Stephanie, I would just say, yeah, I agree with you. When Jesus comes again, for those who believe in the second coming, and it's going to be April 8th, by the way, remember, April Fool's Day will be held on April 8th this year. When he does come again, the earth is his. So what does he need with this account?
This is the same guy who turned water into wine, loaves and fishes, coins inside fishes' mouths. This is that guy, right? He can magically make money, make substance where there was none. Why do we think he's going to use the U.S. currency system? Why do we think that he's going to... None of that makes any sense. And I don't mean that rudely. I just mean that when Jesus comes, if he really is who he claims to be, and he shows up again with a resurrected body and ready to put the earth into submission and reign for 1,000 years... I don't think that $265 billion in land and money from the LDS Church is really going to have much effect for that.
Yeah, and Stephanie, I don't know if you watch the Star Trek movies. There's only one that's really good. But beyond that, there's a great thing where Admiral Kirk asks this trenchant question. He says, what does God need with a starship? And in the same vein, one might ask, what does God need with $150 billion? So just a few different ways.
I don't know. Good question.
Yeah, good question. Yeah.
No, you're quite right. And I appreciate that.
Well, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your calling in. At least we were a little more gentle with you than with Philip.
All right.
Philip, by the way, sorry about that if I was a little rough with you. I'll get my apologies out of the way before the show's over. Then I don't have to track him down and call him up and apologize like Justin.
All right. I've ended the phone call lines. There, we took our three shows. We are good to go.
Our three calls. You know something? Three calls, sorry. When I do just the Radio Free Mormon by myself, and then I play it back and I see I made this mistake, that mistake. You know, I know what I'm talking about usually, but I'm thinking about what I'm saying so much that I misstate something like you just did.
Yeah.
And I wish that I were on a show with somebody else so that they could correct me so it doesn't get, just published that way. But anyway, so yeah.
It doesn't bother me. I mean, correct me. And when you make a mistake, which isn't very often, I'll correct you.
Please do. I invite that. Spencer, thank you so much for being on the show. I know it's very late there. You're on Eastern time as well. So it's going on 11 o'clock there too. When do you have to get up in the morning?
I teach at 8 a.m. That's my first class. That's not too bad.
So 7:55, you're all out of bed?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you so much for staying up late with us. Really appreciate it. Really appreciate your insight and expertise. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Maven backstage, for helping us out with everything that we're doing and all the clips and everything else that you help so much with. And thank you, everybody, watching the show. Thanks for joining us again here on Mormonism Live. Please join us next week when we hope to have Rabbi Joe on the show to talk with us some more about a marvelous work and a wonder and his appearance in defense of the LDS Church. Until then, good night, everybody. Good night.
Mormonism Live. Better than touching your own little fact.